This week on Experts and Intermediates, an East Coast extravaganza. Music, movies, and hey, how about a small vacation to the land that was the 13 original colonies, or at least close by. Plus, we're laying out a new format and digging into some assignments. Stay tuned.
Thanks for joining us. This is Experts and Intermediates with BJ Gailey. I'm Jason Eakin. Want to take a quick moment at the start of this show to do a little bit of housekeeping and set a few things up. We are going to have, as BJ said in the intro, a new format. We'll lay that out here in a second. First, this is officially episode 4, but it's actually episode 3.
Right, right.
Episode 2... did not, well, it got off the ground, but there were some problems with editing.
It didn't get far off the ground.
It didn't get far. I think that's God's way of saying Pirates of the Caribbean 3 did not need its own segment.
Which is too bad, because it was a pretty clever and entertaining segment, at least to Jason and I.
At least to us. We listened to it, gosh, I think 7 times.
At least.
At least.
And that was the night we recorded
that's
it.
That's right. We're real proud. So you've noticed, of course, at the beginning of the last couple of shows, we've had some music.
Yes.
And that music is from a close friend of BJ's, Dan O'Brien. So, BJ.
Yes. Dan O'Brien, one of my best friends in the world, an excellent spades player, among other things. He's also a fantastic musician. All the music we'll be using going forward in the show will be from Dan O'Brien's body of work.
And Dan, thank you so very much. We really appreciate
Very much.
All the music. It's really good music.
It is good music, and it almost makes up for him thinking that Karate Kid is the finest film ever.
It almost does.
Yes.
I think I may have made him mad by saying that Sex and the City is a better action movie than Karate Kid.
But that is entirely accurate. but once again, thanks, Dan, for the music, and we hope all you listeners enjoy it. It is excellent, and you can check out Dan on MySpace.
Otherwise, we are going to move to a new format. Previously, we've been a little too ambitious.
Yes.
For our own gravitas.
As is our wont.
Yeah. And we've been trying to tackle 3 segments on the show. 3 segments is a little too much for us. We tend to go about 20 to 25 minutes. And that makes for a little too much listening for you, the listener.
Yes, yes. We really want to keep it around an hour.
Yeah.
And to do that and get to the depth we want, we're going to shorten it up. We're going to go to 2 main segments.
And then a segment in between those.
Yes.
And that segment is going to be called What Now? and in that segment, it'll be pretty brief each week.
Mm-hmm.
We'll just kind of go through, say we're talking about books and music. Well, then in What Now, we may talk about what movies we're watching right now.
Sure, or television.
Just basically anything we're doing art-related right now that we're not going to get to on the show.
Right.
Is not going to have a full segment devoted to it,
mm-hmm.
But just something else to kind of expand the range of artistic mediums that we're covering.
Absolutely.
We are now going to move on into our first music section. We have yet to actually even talk about our tastes in music. BJ is the expert. I am the sad little man who likes Tom Waits.
But see, this is the thing, that two of Jason's favorite artists, Tom Waits and Amy Mann,
you bet,
are, in my opinion, two of the most intelligent singer-songwriters out there right now. So
okay, yeah, maybe I'm not a complete novice,
right?
But I'm certainly not to your level.
Well,
we're dealing with a man who can give you the history of Wilco at the drop of a hat.
Well,
an unabridged.
It has to be a really light hat. It's got to take its time to get to the ground. But in any case, I think you're going to find that you're prepared for a lot of different kinds of music that maybe you just haven't been introduced to yet. I think your musical taste is setting a pretty high bar, and I hopefully these 3 CDs meet it. But I'm very curious to hear what you thought about The Rising.
Yeah. Okay, so this is my first experience with Bruce Springsteen. I have never listened to him before. I always kind of... He was just always in that category of people for me who I was like, oh, he's older.
He's old, right.
And I was just like, oh, missed the boat.
Yeah, in my opinion, when you first start listening to someone with a body of work as large as Bruce Springsteen or Bob Dylan, God help you.
Yeah.
I mean, it can be very intimidating, and mm-hmm. unless you have somebody saying, "Oh, check out this album. Oh, right. check out this album."
You're pretty much swimming in the dark.
Oh yeah, and you can honestly, in both Bruce Springsteen and Bob Dylan, I think you can pick some poor albums.
And so then you can, okay, so it is good that I've got. It's a good. Lot of direction.
It's good that you have the expert hand guiding you.
That's right. In my Springsteen virginity.
That's right.
I'm about to be deflowered. De-Springsteenized.
Gross.
That is kind of gross.
It is. It's weird.
So take us kind of through your introduction to Bruce Springsteen and why you kind of why you recommended this.
Sure. Okay. My friend Dan O'Brien used to be kind of my lifeline to new music. And we would trade back and forth. He's a musician himself, and he's a big fan of kind of the classic rockers, you know. Okay. I mean, not classic rock per se, but he likes people who have been in the game a while, and he likes singer-songwriters, and Bruce Springsteen certainly falls under that, although he has a band. Bruce Springsteen has the E Street Band. I mean, you know, none of them really, to my knowledge, contribute on songwriting that much. So Bruce Springsteen is very much one of those solo artists who happens to have a regular band he plays with.
That's pretty cool.
Yes, it is pretty cool. And it doesn't influence his sound nearly as much as other people, like, say they play with a band, it really changes their sound. All right, so Dan O'Brien, my friend, introduced me to Bruce Springsteen. I mean, I was obviously familiar with Springsteen's work just because, you know, you run across a song here, a song there. You've never heard Born in the USA?
Oh, yeah.
There you go. See? But The Rising was a big-time album. Dan and I were living on the East Coast when the 9/11 attacks happened.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were living in Baltimore. So we were literally 45 minutes north of the Pentagon and less than 2 hours south of New York. So it was a very strange time to be on the East Coast. And out of that experience, there seemed to come a couple of albums that really brought the experience into an artistic light. And one of them was Bruce Springsteen's The Rising. The thing that impresses me most about this album is that everyone says, oh, it's Springsteen's 9/11 album. It's Springsteen's 9/11 album. Okay, yeah, it is. But the thing that to me is amazing about it is that it is not a reflection merely on the political aspects of 9/11,
right.
nor the personal aspects. It's a combination of the both, and often a combination in the same song.
It actually did not seem to me to be very political.
No.
I didn't find it very political at all. I've heard some much more political music, obviously.
Oh, sure. And I don't know that I have much of a stomach for the much more political stuff, yeah. usually. But, I mean, songs like The Fuse, songs like Worlds Apart, there's certainly a political bent in
sure.
there.
Sure. Okay, that's very interesting. Because those are the songs actually from the album that I've listened to the least.
No, I agree. I agree.
Because I like them the least.
Yes. I have to admit, I always skip Mary's Place.
Oh.
I know. Okay. I know. It's un-American. But, I mean, I have a lot of Springsteen albums now.
Yeah.
And on a lot of them, he kind of does the Mary's Place thing.
Oh,
where it's
okay.
like just kind of feel-good rock. Now, I think Mary's Place occupies a very important place on this album. Because it's really the one song that is free of that 9/11 vibe, I think. It sounds like just a kind of a classic Bruce Springsteen, hey, I got the band, we're gonna play, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas some of the other fun, quote-unquote fun songs, like...
the party songs.
Like, yeah, like Let's Be Friends. I mean, there are lines in Let's Be Friends where it's like, you know, we don't know how long we're gonna be here.
Yeah.
You know, it's still got that underlying message.
Uh-huh.
So even in the lighter moments of The Rising, 9/11 looms.
Okay, so we are now going to get into what I thought of the album.
Yes, please.
On the
Which
whole,
is the whole point.
let's see how many songs there are. 1, 2, 3, 4. There are 15 songs on the album.
Yes.
I would say I probably really like about half of them.
That's good.
I probably like 10 or 11 of them. And then there's about 5 that I just kind of didn't really do it for me.
Gotcha.
And I'll get into those a little bit more later, but I do want to focus on the positive first. On the whole,
mm-hmm.
What I really like about the album is that it seems to have the duality of wanting to be hopeful.
Yes.
In the midst of seeing hopelessness all around you.
Absolutely.
And just like and just the struggle between those two. And I am a man who loves his microcosms. I love a good microcosm, I'll tell you what. And sure enough, I feel like this album has a two-song microcosm of the whole thing.
Okay.
And that would be Counting on a Miracle,
yep,
followed by Empty Sky.
Yeah.
And Counting on a Miracle is basically him saying, I have no idea how anyone could even suggest that something good could come out of this.
Right.
I have no idea what you're talking about, but I think he even says, like, I'm going to believe.
Yeah.
I'm going to believe that you're right.
Yeah. And it's such a small thing, and it's maybe an obvious thing to point out, but when I was re-listening to The Rising in preparation for this, the choice to use the word counting, yes, on a miracle, not like, oh, I hope,
right,
I'm praying for a miracle. No, there has to be one.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly. It's
desperation, but it's not hopeless desperation.
Right. Because if it was hopeless desperation, then he would not be counting on a miracle.
Oh, very good point.
But yeah, so it's like he's reached a point where he can't even think about it in terms of maybe.
Right.
He just has to just go. He's just going all in.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just got to have it. And so I really like that song. It's pretty catchy.
Yeah, it is. It's on this album. It's fairly upbeat, fairly up tempo.
Yeah. Followed by Empty Sky.
Another fairly up tempo song.
Fairly up tempo. Fairly up tempo. And what I like about that song is it's like, I woke up this morning to an empty sky.
Mm-hmm.
And it's totally, you totally have the vision of just like going about your day,
yeah,
as you would on any normal day if you live in the city and you're just walking by and you just look where something very large used to be.
Right.
And there is nothing there.
Yeah.
And the whole notion of just this thing that has always been a part of your life just being
removed. Yep.
It seems almost like aliens have taken it away.
Right.
And I thought that song particularly captured just the hopelessness and just the kind of the frustration of what that feels like.
Mm-hmm.
To have something so big just instantly removed from,
yeah,
from life.
Yeah, and the very notion, like the images that come to mind when you think of the phrase empty sky.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a pretty picture.
No, it's a gray day.
Yeah.
And it's like, I just imagine, you know, all the other buildings, mm-hmm, and then just like looking up and just being like having that second of not even hope, but just expectation that your mind has become accustomed,
right,
to.
Right.
And then just really, really thick disappointment.
Yeah. I mean, I remember that day. You know, it was one of those days where I didn't turn the TV or radio on going into work. And so I went into work. I was the only one at work that day. And I couldn't figure out why. I didn't know what was happening. And so when my bosses came in and told me to turn on the radio, you know, I'm not a New Yorker and I'm not a native, right, East Coaster. But, I mean, in many ways, New York is the heart of America.
Uh-huh.
And I think for all of us that day, it was just an alien experience. Like you said, it was a strange and surreal day. I mean, for everyone, much less someone like Springsteen, who's a New Jersey kid, you know?
Yeah.
So this is very much his hometown.
Right. See, for me, so how old were you?
I was, 23?
Okay. I had turned 18 the day before.
Oh,
September,
yeah,
10th is my, mm-hmm, birthday. I woke up, I'm preparing to go. I actually woke up early because, mm-hmm, my dad called. So I was mad. and he just goes, turn on the TV,
yeah,
something happened.
Yeah.
And so really, because it was me, because I literally woke up to this,
mm-hmm,
it really didn't sink in properly for a while.
No, absolutely not.
Not even, like, stupidly in my senior and high school mind, I think, I thought, well, you know, for a couple of hours, things are going to be rough, and then we'll move on with our day.
Right.
So I, like... My idiotic 18-year-old mind did not even fathom the impact of this.
Well, and how could you? I mean,
exactly.
It's the first attack, if you want to call it that, on American,
right,
soil since Pearl Harbor. It was something that I think absolutely changed the direction of the country.
Yeah.
I mean, since then, 9/11, whether we think about it or not, as part of our daily lives, it is.
Yeah, it
absolutely has changed the political bent. It's changed the artistic bent.
Oh, absolutely.
How
many, I mean, we could just talk, I mean, we're talking about,
sure,
9/11 art in some sense right now.
Absolutely.
And it always, because my favorite book is The Corrections,
mm-hmm,
it was released on like September 8th, 2001.
Right.
So part of the thing I think I've heard Jonathan Franzen talk about in interviews is the idea. It's like he's a New Yorker, so he wants to sympathize with this 9/11 thing, but in the back of his mind, he's still thinking, did my book just become obsolete
right
in 3 days?
Well, and that, I mean, that's the thing. And think of all these things that are released on the cusp of that event.
Yeah.
And how some of them seem preternaturally knowledgeable about the event, you know, and how some of them seem, like you said, just old.
Yeah.
Obsolete. Like, they don't apply anymore to the world we live in.
So, and by the way, I think the corrections absolutely does still apply.
Oh, yeah. Well, it sold a bajillion copies. And
good. I'm glad.
More on the rising.
I did really like Mary's Place. Mm-hmm. Probably my five favorite songs.
Okay.
Are Count on a Miracle, Empty Sky, Mary's Place, You're Missing, and The Rising.
Oh, no, My City of Ruins?
I like that one as well.
Oh, okay.
But those five, for some reason, mm-hmm. You're Missing, may either You're Missing or Empty Sky
mm-hmm.
is my favorite.
You're Missing is an amazing song.
Because You're Missing, really, I feel like that could be one of the ones that he wrote beforehand.
Yeah.
But maybe tweaked afterwards.
Right, or maybe just the experience of 9/11 tweaks it in your mind.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Completely possible.
Yeah, there's a lot of those. I mean, Into the Fire, you listen to it after 9/11, and you're like, this is a 9/11 song. This is about the towers.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't have to be. There's nothing.
No.
Oh, that's the thing about the album. There's very little that's overtly about 9/11. Uh-huh. And to me, this is why it's surprising that you didn't mention My City of Ruins to me. Because My City of Ruins to me does something so beautiful in songwriting, I think, in that he starts off the song that is very much about a city that has been destroyed.
Right.
He talks about young men on the corners like scattered leaves, people walking through their days like zombies, not knowing what to do.
That's right.
And so you're listening to it and you're thinking, okay, this is the 9/11 song.
Uh-huh.
And then in the final verse, he makes it about a relationship. He twists it ever so slightly, and it doesn't change the meaning of anything before it.
Nope.
But it does.
It just adds to it.
It adds to it. Exactly. It gives it that other layer that I think is so good. This is what this album does so well.
I'll have to add My CD.
Well, no pressure. I
remember having a gut reaction. Mm-hmm. But then I got wound up in my little microcosm.
Oh, hey,
which I liked.
I think the microcosm is absolutely accurate. Those are the two tracks that I think occupy the two sides of this album.
Mm-hmm.
The personal, the political, the hopeful and the hopeless. And you know, the other thing I think is great, another great duality, is the desire for revenge. He talks about, mm-hmm. in fact, saying eye for an eye.
Yeah,
but then,
he does.
But then he, in the very next song, he talks about turning the other cheek. He talks about the need to forgive.
Yeah.
And which I just think, especially for when it was released, I mean, this is not an album that was released 3 or 4 years after 9/11.
No.
This is an album that was released very much in the center of right. the dealing with the event.
At a time when it was very difficult to really, objectivity was very hard to come by.
Absolutely.
And I don't mean that in the sense that I'm trying to pick on anyone or
belittle
any type of subjectivity that was there. I think all told, it was pretty objective given the circumstances.
sure. But I mean, to talk about forgiveness at a time like that, I think is a brave thing and a very, you know, very Christian thing, I think.
It is a very Christian thing, but it's something that I wasn't thinking about.
No. And it's great because he gives both sides their voice, you know? And I think both sides probably existed in a lot of people at that time.
I think so. Like, that is the thing that's so great about this album, is that all of these feelings mm-hmm. are, not only do they touch every different side and mm-hmm. bent that there is, but they also touch the people that are kind of like us, who sort of feel all those things at different times. And I think most people probably feel, you know, forgiving and then immediately non-forgiving.
Right.
It's like, you know, you start thinking about, okay, I can, you know, we need to move on. We need to forgive these people. Then you see something else, and you're like,
And you're vindictive again. You want blood, and you know, and maybe there was blood due. Who knows?
Sure,
but
exactly.
I mean, the great thing about Springsteen is he can say, I feel both those things. Both those things are natural.
And both of those things are absolutely valid.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's the great thing. I like it when things are didactic without being preachy.
Yes. Oh, yes. Perfect.
That's my favorite mix
mm-hmm.
is when someone can pull that off. And I think he does.
Yeah.
And I think he wants all these things to be discussed and felt and talked about.
But he's not trying to push it any one way.
Right.
He's just trying to say, you know, if you're going to be thinking these things, mm-hmm. try to think about these other things as well.
Now, do you think him not wanting to push it one way or another, or maybe not even being willing to push it one way or another, do you think that makes it a weaker as a whole? Do you think it makes it a weaker album?
Like I said, I like it when people take a stand, mm-hmm. but on something as complex as this and for the time it was written,
right.
I don't think that's the time to take a stand.
Yeah,
I agree. You know, I think that's the time to really reflect and discuss as much as possible, mm-hmm. and really stay away from making any
right.
brash
because,
decisions.
Well, yeah, and because you don't know what you're truly feeling. You
right.
know?
Yeah. There's no hindsight at that point.
Right.
You know, there's no distance mm-hmm. from it whatsoever. When you can still see smoke, maybe that's not the time to be making some decisions.
True.
I do want to mention, I think, like, probably Mary's Place and The Rising, to me, are the two that are just, like, the most just kind of rocking.
Yes, absolutely.
And, The Rising even has some, like, na-na-nas.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, but, and you know what? Swear to God, loved them. Sang along with them.
Yeah, it's great. It's that kind of song. And I mean, that's the whole point of The Rising, is that it's a call to unity, I think.
It absolutely is.
And I think it's great that he echoes that in My City of Ruins. Like, he brings it back a couple tracks later where there's a choir singing.
Yeah.
The choir joins on With These Hands, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that's very much the sentiment of The Rising, the song, and the album in general, I think.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of times that can go real bad.
Oh, yeah, sure. And,
but it never did. It
good.
It really swept me up into it
nice.
And made me want to be a part of it as
yeah.
opposed to making me.
Yeah, making you cringe and say, oh, this is terribly cheesy.
Yeah. Speaking of terribly cheesy.
Uh-oh, let's see.
We will now. Oh, I will say that You're Missing, I just love because, as the title suggests, it's pretty much about this. You know, as Empty Sky is about these buildings that used to be there,
yep.
it's about this woman or this person mm-hmm. who is supposed to be there,
right.
and it goes through all of these different things. You're supposed to be at this thing, you're
right.
supposed to be at that thing, and you're missing. And of course, it's like, has she left?
Yeah,
Did she die?
Yep.
Is this even related to 9/11? Or is she one of those unclaimed bodies that
right.
they don't know where she is?
Yeah.
And that really kind of got to me.
It's a great song, and it's, I think, one of the strengths of it is that it's so simple.
Yeah.
You know, it's just about this presence in your life that's missing, mm-hmm. and all the little tiny, tiny things. One of the lines that's repeated in the song is, everything is everything, but
yep.
you're missing.
Everything is everything.
And it's like, nothing has changed except everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just such a great sentiment.
Okay, so.
Terribly cheesy. I can't wait to hear this.
My least two favorite songs
mm-hmm.
are Worlds Apart and Let's Be Friends.
Yeah.
Those songs suck. Those songs. I'm being harsh, but they just after Count on a Miracle and Empty Sky, then there was this really big tonal shift
mm-hmm.
and it sounded, I'm probably completely wrong here, but it sounded very African. Like, there's some, like, tribal things going on.
Well, and that gets introduced, I think, in Worlds Apart, and it does get continued. Now, I mean, do you think those songs still have a place on the album?
Maybe they do, but they didn't. They just didn't have anything near the power of the songs before them
right.
or the songs after them.
This is true.
And the songs, or the album is 15 songs long anyway. It's 73 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Get rid of these songs. That's 10 minutes you can get rid of. You're still over an hour.
Yeah.
And I would say, the album as a whole would be stronger
minus
those two songs.
I'm not willing to say cut them off, but I will
yeah.
say that I usually skip those songs when I'm
okay.
playing it in my car. I do still hold on to the fact that I do think they do contribute thematically to the album.
Okay, so I rarely find music that has what I feel like is bad music.
Oh,
and
sure.
some of the music on here and the songs that I just mentioned, and
mm-hmm.
I think one other one, but I can't remember which one it is because I did not listen to it a second time.
Gotcha.
Sounded like bad contemporary Christian music.
Ooh, that's pretty harsh.
And that is a harsh criticism. I was like, did Clay Cross get in here somewhere? Point of Grace produce this album? What's the deal?
You know that Bruce Springsteen is listening to this right now and is getting in his car.
He's
going
to go kill Clay Cross.
Probably. And then
maybe I'm okay.
He'll beat you to death with Clay Cross.
He'll beat me to death with Clay's Cross. Anyway,
okay,
so some of the music was I felt like it was achingly bad.
Wow.
And I was like, ooh, Springsteen, where are you getting this?
So, like, but so surprising. Like, you're listening to the album, you're like, okay, this is good, this is good. And then you get to a couple.
And then I went, arf? I couldn't believe it.
Well, I will say that upon listening to The Rising again to prepare for this, and I have listened to this album scores of times.
Wow.
It's a very important album in my own personal history.
Okay.
And listening to the album again, it was simultaneously as good as I remembered it and worse than I remembered
it.
Yeah, because of there, like you said, there are a couple songs, especially right in the middle, that just aren't nearly as good. And there are a couple songs that a lot of people love. Mary's Place made it onto his essential, his three-disc essential collection.
Mary's Place
is on there. My City of Ruins, missing in action.
Uh-oh.
And My City of Ruins is probably one of my top 10 favorite songs. Yeah, I will say that on record.
I've whistled twice. I need to stop that.
That's
all
right.
Top 10 favorites of all time.
That song absolutely moves me. I just think that shift is so good. And so few people could have pulled it off. And I think Springsteen is usually a fairly straightforward writer, but he writes from the heart. And I think he absolutely did that in City of Ruins, but he actually kind of took it up a notch.
Okay.
In my opinion.
So this album, as an introduction to Springsteen, I can say that it definitely made me want to listen to more Springsteen.
Excellent.
I am interested to see what he has done before.
Good.
And
go back
to the beginning.
The early stuff especially will be very interesting to listen to because it's pretty much straightforward rock, and there's a whole mess of his stuff that's just pretty much, hey, I'm a young kid, I'm going to play guitar.
Oh, okay.
And he's just...
not quite as interesting.
It's not quite as interesting, but it's great to listen to. And one of his earlier albums is Nebraska, which is him at his most introspective, in my opinion.
I'll take it.
Yeah, that's probably the next one to listen to.
Okay, we are going to take another short break, and we will be right back. Stay with us.
Hey everybody, welcome back to Experts and Intermediates with Jason Eakin. I'm BJ Gailey.
No, you're not.
I try to be. And this is our new What Now
What
segment,
Now?
The inaugural What Now.
That's right. And you have to say, this segment is about attitude. I think that's pretty
evident. It is.
It's not, hey, what now? It's what now?
What now? Yeah. It's like Poochie from The Simpsons.
It's
full of attitude.
I thought you were going to say Poochie from... the new film El Cantante.
No, no.
Because I read a review and Jennifer Lopez's name in the movie is honest to God Poochie.
No, it's not.
Yes,
Poochie?
It is. That's what they call her. Apparently, the bitch has a real name, but they just call her Poochie.
Poochie.
And I've heard that movie is about as good as that name.
Well, let me tell you that I never thought El Cantante would even get a mention on Experts and Intermediates.
I've been waiting to.
I know you've been angling how to work it in.
You know that's why we created this podcast.
Right, What Now is actually going to be renamed El Cantante. Or Poochie. Poochie segment, as we like to refer to it.
Or as the movie is titled for, The Content.
Is that what that means?
Hell no, I don't know.
Oh, gee, I thought you spoke Spanish.
I took 4 years of Spanish. Here's what I know. Left Almos.
Left, which I can't believe is real, by the way.
It's not.
Oh.
But it's awesome. Anyway, so this segment is just about what we're doing now. So, BJ, what have you been up to recently?
Not a lot. I actually finished the last Harry Potter.
Oh, that's okay. That's huge.
Well, it's huge and not huge. I definitely enjoyed it. That actually may be my favorite of the series, to be honest. But you kind of go into, at least I've noticed, after I read a Harry Potter book, there's that segment I think I talked to you about where all you want to do is read the book, and then you finish, and you don't want to read anything else. You just really want another Harry Potter book, which is sad. So I've been putting off starting another book. I really do. I have on my shelf ready to be read. I Am Legend.
Oh, that's right.
Which
you're
which I'm finally getting back around to, and I'm looking very much forward to starting. But really, what I've been doing the last couple weeks since I finished Harry Potter is reading every comic book I can get my hands on.
I was in your car recently,
yeah,
and you had like like 4 or 5 new comic books.
Oh yeah.
Among the stacks that are in your room.
Oh yeah, well, in the stacks, I haven't even made my way through all those.
Jeez.
Not to mention all like the DVD ROMs that I have, like hundreds of comic books on. My goal is to get through every comic I own in the next year.
Are you kidding?
Oh no, this is another unattainable goal I've set for
myself. I'm sorry, folks. We gotta go. BJ's got some reading to do. Goodbye.
But that's what I've been doing, and it's kind of cathartic in a way to read really terrible like mid-90s comics, because it really makes you value the things that you love in your life because you don't love these terrible, terrible comic books.
Right.
So that's what I've been up to. What about you?
I actually just got back from a trip to New York.
Yes.
Which ties into today's podcast rather nicely.
It actually does.
But you know it does. I made you say it in the intro.
I know, but I thought I'd act surprised.
Wow. Actor extraordinaire. Experts in actors. So, I got to go to New York. I actually went by myself, mm-hmm. which I wasn't anticipating. But I tell you what, it turned out to be fantastic.
Uh-huh.
I really filled every day. I went to, I think, 3 museums. And I got to see a lot of really great art.
Mm-hmm.
I think I actually met quite a few people. Mm-hmm. I met a very pretty girl, and I've told you that story.
Yes.
So it's kind of a romantic interlude for me as well. It was a nice surprise. But I looked at a lot of really great Picasso stuff. I think I'm not sure what it's called. I'll put the picture on the website, mm-hmm. For people to see. But it's just this woman reading at a table, basically by candlelight.
You told me that.
And I stood by this painting for probably 10 minutes, it's the kind of thing that makes you want to be really quiet.
Yeah, that's nice.
And it just, if you have something to say about it, you almost just kind of want to whisper it. You don't want to, because it's just, it's very, it's somber in a sweet way, I guess.
Nice. Now, are you a painting guy normally?
The thing is, I mean, I couldn't tell you really anything about painting, mm-hmm. or painting history or anything like that. But I really do enjoy going to museums, mm-hmm. and looking at paintings with someone. So I was lucky. Then at the there was also, I'm a big fan of Jackson Pollock, only because, mm-hmm. I saw the movie Pollock.
Yeah.
It is a good movie, and so, again, just sat and stared at some of his stuff, mm-hmm. for just long spells of time, and I think what was called Autumn Rhythm.
Oh, yeah.
And of course, it's massive.
His canvases are huge.
I mean, it's probably 15 feet tall by 20 feet wide, mm-hmm. so it's so overwhelming in a really great way. And then at the Museum of Modern Art, I saw this painting called The Lovers.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll put the picture. I took some pictures of the pictures, not because that really captures them, but just so that I would remember.
Because you were feeling postmodern.
That's right. Of course. As is my way. But no, and so the picture is very simple. It's these two people kissing, only both of them have bags over their head. And it's not like a plastic bag or a paper bag. It's like a very it's like a cloth bag almost. And so they're kissing and embracing, but obviously they cannot see each other. So it could be about, you know, love is blind.
Yeah.
Or it could be that they don't know each other,
yeah.
as well as they think that they do, or something. So all sorts of really great stuff.
Nice.
So then I got to see the Decemberists.
One of your favorites.
For the second time in 6 months, and oh boy, that was just a great night.
Nice.
And the great thing is, and I think I told you this, I've told a lot of people this, but the girl I met in New York, mm-hmm. went with me to the concert, and there is nothing better than listening to some great music that you really love with a girl. I don't think there's anything that like tops that, at least not for me. So that's what I've been doing. So I've been artsy in New York.
Well, I love that this segment has been about you've been seeing great art and listening to great music, and I've been reading Deathlok the Demolisher. I think that really sums up Experts and Intermediates right now.
It sort of does. So, well, is there anything else you want to talk about? I know you've been watching something really interesting that I think you should. We may do a segment on it later.
Oh, Planet Earth.
Yeah.
Oh, sure. I think we definitely should do a segment on Planet Earth.
We will. It's so unique. Tell them about it.
Yeah, Planet Earth, for those of you who don't know, was a miniseries that was, aired on BBC. But it is phenomenal. I mean, I tend to enjoy watching nature documentaries in general, but this is filmed entirely with state-of-the-art high-def cameras, and it's the first nature documentary I've ever seen that looks like a film. I mean, there's a whole like meta narrative going on over this 13-hour series.
I was going to ask you how long it was.
Yeah, it is gorgeous and moving, and just everything you tend to not expect from a nature documentary. Yeah. I think so, and informative. But it never lets the facts get in the way of producing captivating images,
right?
And having emotional resonance, which is kind of hard to do sometimes when you're talking about flying squirrels. But totally wonderful, and as soon as I can get it to you, watch it, because I think it really deserves its whole segment, and it would be a good first television segment. I know we got a lot of TV segments coming up that we're gonna do, but that would be a good first one.
Well, so that is What Now.
Yes.
That's pretty much what it'll be every week. And if you've got anything that you've been watching or reading or whatnot, let us know, because we're always curious to know what other people are doing.
We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back to talk about the first of my assignments, The Departed.
Welcome back. This is Experts and Intermediates. Thanks for sticking with us. We are moving on now to the assignment section. My assignment for BJ, was the 2006 film that won Best Picture, Best Director, Best Screenplay, and Best Editing. And that is Martin Scorsese's The Departed. The reason I assigned this is because it was my favorite movie of last year. Mm-hmm. A lot of people kind of consider it, I think I said this before, a lesser Scorsese movie. And I really do disagree. He is one of my favorite filmmakers. He's been that for a long time. But really, I didn't have much of an expectation for this movie other than it's Scorsese, so I wanted to see it.
Right.
But after seeing it, I was like, this movie, it's not the kind of movie that wins, you know, a lot of Oscars. Mm-hmm. It's the kind of movie that's like, oh, you know, critics really liked it, and then so long. we got to do Letters from Iwo Jima now. That's really what I thought. So so the fact that it was even considered for Oscars was just mind-boggling to me. So a lot of great things about it. But that is why I assigned it. So BJ,
yes,
knowing my decadent love of this movie going in, were you caught up in the story in the same way I was, or did you feel that Mr. Scorsese may have lost his A game?
Oh, well, I got to tell you, when The Departed was out, I knew that it got a lot of critical buzz, and I knew that, you know, the minute the movie came out, even before the movie came out, a lot of people were talking, well, this is going to be the one Scorsese wins for, whether he deserves it or not.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's always the phrase that gets bandied about, I feel like. I didn't have really, like you said, any expectations about this film. I didn't want to see it necessarily in theaters. I think if I would have gotten around to seeing it with someone, it would have been like that. That was fine, but it wasn't one where I was like, oh, I got to go see this, which is odd, because I'm the guy who's got to go see Fantastic Four 2, even though I know it's going to be terrible. But, you know, I tend to avoid this kind of film simply because I feel like so many times you see a crime drama like this and it's the same crime drama you've seen three times. Well, let me tell you, the first 30 minutes of this film, less than that, the first 15 or 10 minutes, I pop the movie in. Jack Nicholson starts off with this monologue that, you know, I was like, okay, take it or leave it. And then the movie really kind of starts, and it starts, I believe, on the DVD. The segment is called Training Ends or something like that.
Okay.
But it's basically a montage of the main characters in the police academy. Mm-hmm. By the time that segment ends, I was prepared to describe this as one of the finest films I'd ever seen. I was instantly hooked by this movie. The first 30 minutes of the movie play like a masterclass in filmmaking. You just watch it and you soak it in, and the whole time you're thinking, this is great. I mean, you got razor-sharp dialogue, you've got stellar performances, vivid and believable characterizations, I thought. I really loved every character in this movie.
Yeah.
There was no character that I thought was given short shrift. I didn't feel like any character was unnecessary to the plot.
Mm-hmm.
There were some maybe I was less interested in, but not by much.
Right.
Even supporting characters, I feel like, shone. And the whole time I was really thinking, a movie like The Departed, a film like The Departed, really reminds you of the difference between a director and a visionary. every shot was so painstakingly laid out.
Uh-huh.
The pacing was flawless. I really was just completely absorbed by the film. As you know, I hate Leonardo DiCaprio. I really, every time someone says, Leonardo DiCaprio's great, I'm like, in what? What movie was he in that I missed that he was great in? And granted, I haven't seen The Aviator yet.
Which you own.
Which I own and haven't seen.
Right.
But I kept waiting for that performance that was going to make me a believer in this kid's supposedly supernatural acting ability. and I got to say, this was the film. He's awesome in this. He is gentle. He creates a character that is at times completely harsh, completely unlikable. And then in the next moment, completely sympathetic and vulnerable,
yeah.
Sometimes in the same scene.
Uh-huh.
The arc of change for his character, it's one of the few performances I can put my finger on as saying, I understood at every moment exactly what that character was going through,
uh-huh.
Even if the character did not, which right. is precisely what you're supposed to do as an actor. The only person who even comes close, and he comes within an inch, is Matt Damon. In this film, who gives his finest performance, as near as I can tell, and that is saying something because I like me some Matt Damon.
Yeah.
He is a guy, I would have slept with Matt Damon's character in this film. He is that smooth.
That's actually great to hear because a friend of mine, Tyler, we'll say friend of the show, he has a podcast, Battleship Pretension.
Yes.
You can visit it at battleshippretension.com. It's a really fun podcast all about movies. But he and I were talking about that with DiCaprio, he was afraid that Matt Damon was going to get almost overlooked. His talent, because he is, you know, an all-American, like, he's very good-looking.
Sure.
He's very smart. That people are almost like, oh, Matt Damon's going to be really good. And he is, and he disappears into the role so completely, they seem to miss him even when they step back and try to be objective.
It does seem to me that sometimes when people talk about Matt Damon, there's that tone that's always like, oh, you know, Ben Affleck's friend.
Right.
Which is so ridiculous because that's kind of an outdated relationship and definition of him. But I really, he's a kind of guy that I would really like to dislike because he is good looking and kind of reliably talented.
Yeah.
But he's phenomenal in this film.
Yeah, and he's never boring. He's never... I mean, in any performance, really, you know, Ben Affleck's decent performances, you can count on three fingers.
It's true.
But
very
Matt
true.
Damon, in the last 3 years, you need all 10 fingers and toes.
Absolutely. And he's continually walks that line between summer blockbuster and quote-unquote important film.
Yeah.
You know?
Consider, here are his last four movies.
Yeah.
Starting with The Departed. He did The Departed.
Mm-hmm.
Only 2 months later, he was in The Good Shepherd, which, if you compare the two performances, are night and day.
Yeah.
After that, he waits a couple of months, and then he's in Ocean's 13,
right.
in which he is hysterical.
Yes, he's the highlight of the film.
He is. He absolutely is.
Mm-hmm.
And then he takes another turn, and he's Jason Bourne.
Yeah. What an unexpected action star.
Yeah,
Matt Damon is.
Very true.
You know, and it's because I really do believe he approaches a character first, know, and it absolutely works. And, of course, he's helped by some very claustrophobic shaky camera work,
yes.
which I enjoy and I think works for those films. But it also hides the fact that Matt Damon is probably not a black belt. But still, man, you watch a Bourne movie and you really do buy him.
Yeah. And so here he's got the task of being the guy that if we have to choose who we want to root for, we're not supposed to pick him.
Right. He's the bad guy.
Right.
You know? And yet, he's infinitely more likable at the beginning of the film than
Absolutely.
Leonardo DiCaprio's character.
Leonardo DiCaprio is at the beginning of the movie, difficult to watch. There's a scene, I actually just took a look at it before recording this, where Matt Damon goes into the office with Martin Sheen and Mark Wahlberg.
Yeah.
And he has his say, and then he comes out, and DiCaprio goes in.
Yeah.
If you compare just like a still photograph of the two of them, and I think at one point Damon walks by DiCaprio looks like a 15-year-old kid.
Oh, yeah.
Like, he looks like nothing.
It's an intensely uncomfortable scene. Throughout the movie, what I think Scorsese does so well is that he continually points out the line between these two characters, where they are different, and then throughout the movie, they move closer and closer to being the same, I think.
Hmm.
And that's actually the main thing I got from the movie was my end thought on my little note sheet here is it's an amazing meditation on how we define ourselves and the common end we all come to, which is perfectly phrased by Jack Nicholson in the movie, where he talks to a character who says, he says, how's your mother doing? And the character says, not so good. She's on her way out. And he says, we all are. Act accordingly.
Yeah.
I mean, it's no surprise that when the movie's called The Departed, there's going to be a lot of dead bodies at the end of the day. And the movie for me is filled with people who are desperately searching for an identity or trying to escape the identity that their surroundings give to them.
Mm-hmm. This moves perfectly in the direction of what I think is the most, the most interesting thing, important thing about the movie. At the beginning of the film, in Nicholson's monologue, he delivers a line that's in the trailer, cops and robbers, when you're facing a loaded gun, what's the difference?
Yeah.
And the movie, it seems to me, goes about for the rest of its 2.5 hours saying exactly how he is correct and exactly how he is wrong.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's what I think is so fascinating, is that you're absolutely right. In the end, you know, from almost a physical perspective, they all come to they are exactly the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just another dead body after a dead body after a dead body. But if you look at if you look at Damon and DiCaprio, you know, I think they actually start out similar.
Oh yes, no, they basically start kind of in the same neighborhood, and the choices they make or the choices that people around them make takes them on these different paths.
Yeah. And so you've got DiCaprio who comes from a troubled home but is trying to do something good.
Yes.
And then you've got Damon who, you know, it has kind of been taken under the wing of Jack Nicholson and is kind of starting out to do something bad.
Yes.
And so
from a very young age.
And so you've got these two characters So Damon's already like kind of in the position of the mole or the
yes rat oh yeah yeah whatever. It's like he's being groomed for that. Whereas DiCaprio, it seems like throughout the movie, especially in the scene in the office where they're calling him a lace curtain mofo, and he's trying to escape back to the streets almost. You know, he's trying to get back his respect and get back his credibility.
Right.
It's a remarkable film for a number of reasons, but also how well Scorsese, and it seems like he always does this, portrays a neighborhood.
And in this movie, very dissimilar from his others, he goes on both sides of the law.
Right.
So often it's just the mob, and here he splits his time, and I think that also goes back. It's the whole duality thing of cops and robbers. Is there really a difference?
Yep.
And I think what is so fascinating is the psychological journey of both of these characters, because they're in the same position. They are both one thing, and they're pretending to be the opposite.
Yes.
But the question is the observation is, you will be affected differently based on your starting point and based on what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm.
For instance, Matt Damon is essentially trying to achieve, you could say, just where I'm paring it down, but negative ends. He is trying to do something very much against the law.
Sure.
As a result, his character grows more and more impotent.
Yes.
Literally. Literally and emotionally.
Mm-hmm.
DiCaprio, on the other hand, is trying to at least do something good.
Mm-hmm.
And so, whereas Matt Damon seems to move further and further away from others, DiCaprio desires more and more to be around someone and to have a genuine emotional connection.
Yes,
and
yes.
That leads him to ask the shrink out on a date and things like that.
Yeah, and he's also the one pursuing meds to try and get him back to a place he can identify. He's losing himself in the act, whereas Damon is just sort of eliminating himself.
Right.
You know, he's erasing his personality, whereas DiCaprio's desperately trying to hold on, desperately trying to find a personality.
Right. DiCaprio seems to just be desperate for just some shred of something genuine.
Yes, well, and when he comes out of his deep undercover work, that's all he wants. He comes to Damon, who he has no idea is a mole inside the department, and Damon's, you know, talking about how he's going to get all these awards and stuff like that, and DiCaprio's like, here's what I want. I want to get paid, and I want my life back.
Right. And he's like, yeah, you'll be a cop. I understand. He's like, no, I want my life.
Right.
And here's the thing. Like, I haven't seen the film it's based on. I guess it's a Hong Kong action movie, Infernal Affairs. But I can't imagine that that movie delves into the psychological aspects as fully and as completely as Martin Scorsese does in what is essentially a genre picture.
It should be a cop thriller.
Yeah.
And it works on that level to a certain extent.
Yeah.
But that is not the aim. Seems like that primarily is given really secondary attention. And I think that is actually part of my problem with the conclusion of the film.
Okay.
As gung-ho as I was about the first, say, hour and a half or so of the film, pretty much starting from, starting from Martin Sheen's death, I really do feel like the film does lose a little bit of that really, really sharp focus. Okay. That the first hour and a half has. I really feel like there's not a moment wasted in the first hour and a half. Not a shot wasted. Everything is moving towards this end. And yet when Sheen dies, it's like I think the movie kind of goes for about 15 minutes. Oh, okay, what's going on? Uh-huh. What's happening now? And at least that's what I did watching it.
Right.
And I hate the last image. Last image of the rat on the balcony. The CGI rat.
The CGI. Well, but it's not just a CGI rat on the balcony. It's a CGI rat overlooking a church.
Oh, sure. And I love the iconography of the church throughout the film.
Yes.
I mean, Matt Damon is constantly looking up to this church. Growing up in the neighborhood, he gets his huge, awesome apartment, and it's right by the church.
Right.
So he gets a wonderful view of it.
Oh, and that's kind of the thing that that was the path he was on.
Yes.
And Nicholson basically grabbed him out of church.
Right. And so it does make you wonder if it's something he regrets at all.
Absolutely.
There are moments, I think, where you can see that and can make a point
that. I think absolutely.
But I don't know. I kind of felt like the rat was like the one heavy-handed moment in the film.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, why was that necessary? Can't we just have the shot of the church?
Uh-huh.
You know, I think that would have been nice.
Yeah, I could have. I could see that. Although it did kind of bring a smirk to my face. I do completely understand what you're saying. But I was just with him so much and for so much of the movie that I was just at that point, I was just with him.
It's a minor qualm in a movie that I think is a complete success.
Mm-hmm.
It really is tightly, tightly crafted and really insightful. And it features some of the strongest performances I can think of in recent memory. It really is, in every way, shape, and form, this assignment was such an eye-opener for me.
Okay, so we've mentioned that this could have been a genre picture.
Sure.
I think that
could have been an action movie.
Yeah, I think that if this was directed by somebody else, then one, I think the guts and the heart of the script would have been chucked, and we would have had probably a couple more, you know, gun battles and stuff like that. But it would have had more violence probably, but I don't think the violence would have been as effective.
Yes, I think the reason the violence is so effective for me in this film is because it is used very sparingly, and also it tends to come out of nowhere. It happens very suddenly.
Yes, it is sudden, and it is not. It's not something that, I mean, to take another Matt Damon movie, it's not something you get up and walk away from.
No, it's completely unglamorous. It is, and I do feel like that's one of the things the Bourne movies do really well. They make the violence really ugly.
They are pretty gritty.
But it's still like action movie ugly.
Yes.
You know, this is about as far from an action movie as you can get in terms of violence. There are a number of shootings, and they're all fairly, not even graphic, just kind of fairly real and fairly disturbing.
Right. I think the reason this movie works so well for me is because of the ending. Because I can honestly say that when DiCaprio's got Damon in that elevator, and there's a great exchange where Matt Damon, for once, he lets him...
You see the real character.
And he says, just kill me.
Yeah.
And DiCaprio's like, I just did.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, DiCaprio's going to win. You know, this is that's how it's going to go. Elevator door opens. DiCaprio's shot, and he's dead.
Yeah,
it. There's no speech. There's
nothing.
Not even like a last second before.
Oh, no.
Before.
There's no moment of. There's no moment of realization on
Absolutely
DiCaprio's
not.
Part that he's going to die. There's no peace made. It's just death.
It's just death. Sometimes a director will do that almost to like scoff at his character and be like, see, look what I can do to this character.
Right.
But this does not feel that way at all. It never feels like. There's still absolutely a sadness about it.
Sure. It in no way feels like shock for shock's sake.
Exactly. And you know what? I think, again, a testament to Matt Damon, the ending, even though I was glad that Matt Damon got killed, I still felt bad about it.
Sure. Well, he's completely demoralized by the end of the film. even though he's in a position of nearly complete power.
Yes.
Which it would seem to be is what he was kind of striving for all his life.
Right.
But, you know, it's the movie's very Shakespearean, to be honest. It's, you know, heavy is the head that wears the crown.
Right.
So that concludes my first assignment, The Departed. If you agree or disagree or have some extra thoughts to add, email us at feedbackbjason@hotmail.com. Yep. We'd love to hear it.
We absolutely would. Or visit us on MySpace, mm-hmm. Or go to our website that you got this podcast from.
Right.
And so anywhere you like, or give us a phone call. Come over to my house. Just talk to us, please.
Drop by. The Departed was not good.
That's right.
Punch.
All right. Okay, so that is going to wrap up this episode of Experts and Intermediates. Next week on the show, another assignment-filled show.
Yes, yes. My second assignment, Tristram Shandy. And Jason's second assignment, Bob Dylan's Blood on the Tracks.
Mr. Bob Dylan. So we are looking forward to that. Please join us again next week for Experts and Intermediates. I am Jason Eakin.
I'm BJ Gailey.
See you later.